I wanted to talk briefly about some of the common questions that we get at the firm after July 1st, 2012, and then walk through four of what I think are the most impactful cases that we've seen over the last 12 months or so. So the most common question that I probably get as a practitioner is from our owner-contractor clients who are asking about all the forms, or from our supplier-subcontractor clients who are saying, I was handed a contract form and the exhibits are the old statutory waivers and releases, and I'm being asked to sign the old statutory waivers and releases. What do I do? And so the answer as a supplier or a sub is, who cares? At worst, you are giving up your statutory rights, and at best, you haven't given up anything. So if you're a supplier or a sub, it doesn't really matter. But it does reemphasize for you owners and prime contractors, I direct contractors as of July 1st, 2012, for you guys, you got to make sure that you do use the new forms. And I still see it. There's a huge direct contractor that I saw the other day that's still using the old forms. And it's giving it to our clients, to our sub and supplier clients. So we know that there are folks that are still not using the new form. So it's imperative that we do so. So I do want to talk about a couple of cases. I'm going to talk about three private work cases and one public case that came out over the last 12 months or so that have some impact on statutory remedies. The first one that I have is the Cal Sierra versus Comerica Bank case. And this is one which really impacts lenders and their ability to challenge a subcontractor or a supplier's claim on a bonded stop notice or a mechanics lien using a Lambert motion. And I know some of you know what a Lambert motion is and some of you don't. A Lambert motion is that which came from a 1991 California appellate case by the name of Lambert. And that case had looked back at a California Supreme Court case in 1976 called Connolly, which had upheld the constitutionality of mechanics lien and bonded stop notices and stop notices in the state of California, even though it constitutes a taking of a property owner's property. And in Lambert, the California appellate case decided to swing the pendulum a little bit back towards the property owner whose property was being taken. So in Lambert, what the court said is, we have an expedited procedure for you, property owner. If you believe that the claimant doesn't have a valid claim, you can go ahead and file a motion to try to expunge a stop notice or a mechanics lien. And it shifts the burden to the claimant to establish the probable validity of the claim. So it's sort of a big deal, especially for property owners. Well, in Cal Sierra, what had happened was the lender, Comerica, and its affiliated lenders had filed a Lambert motion claiming that the $2 million claim by Cal Sierra, and this is on a Dunmore Homes project up in Placer County, and Dunmore Homes, as you all know, probably went bankrupt a few years ago. And in that slide to bankruptcy, they stopped paying Cal Sierra. So Cal Sierra did its mechanics lien, it did its bonded stop notice, and the lender came in and said, we don't think you have a valid claim, we think you've been overpaid, you haven't completed certain work, so we're going to file a Lambert motion. And the court looked at it and said, you know, we don't think this is an appropriate thing for you, a lender, because at the end of the day, we're concerned about the lien that's attaching to the property owner's realty or the garnishment on the construction funds, which is really the property owner's funds, not you, lender. You already gave the funds, and you have a secured interest in that property. So you are not entitled to use the Lambert device, the Lambert motion. So it was a big deal for lenders last year in this Cal Sierra case. This next case, Shady Tree Farms, comes out of the Granite Park construction project in Fresno a couple years ago. And this is one where a landscaping contractor was asserting its lien rights on this private work of improvement. And it was under the old statute, under Civil Code 3097. And what had happened in Shady Tree is the contractor had delivered 950 mature trees, had a $2 million contract to do so, and a direct contract with the owner. So it didn't think that it needed to do a preliminary notice. Because arguably under the old statute, under 3097, there was an argument to be made that if you were a quote-unquote direct or a prime contractor, what we know of as a prime contractor, you don't need to serve a preliminary notice upon a construction lender. And there, the trial court disagreed, and the lenders came in and said, well, we think that's wrong, and we're going to appeal it. And they did, and they went through the inartful language, as our appellate court pointed out, of 3097, which really underscores the need for this overhaul that we had last July, where we took all the conflicting terms like original contractor and direct contractor and subcontractor and contractor, and called anybody that has a direct contractual relationship with the owner as a quote-unquote direct contractor. So the court here said, no, we're not going to let you off. You had to serve a preliminary notice. And my point from this case is that I think it Shady Tree, under the new law, clearly would have had to serve a preliminary notice, because under 8200E, it really does specify, and in this specific case where you have a direct contractor that may not be a quote-unquote prime or a general contractor, that any contractor with a direct contractual relationship with the owner must serve a preliminary notice if there is a lender. Okay. The third case is a public works case, and this, I think, is the most impactful of the last, say, 12 or 14 months. And I actually spoke to counsel on this appellate case this morning to get their thoughts about it. And what's interesting is I think they're sort of a little bit at a loss as well at what this appellate court did in the third district. And the key issue here was, who is entitled to make a claim on a California Works payment bond? And we all think, well, okay, as long as you are a subcontractor to the direct contractor, maybe you're a sub-sub, maybe you're a material supplier to a sub, you're okay. And that's probably still the knowledge and what we think is correct is probably still correct. What they did in this case, and I'll give you a little bit of the background, Flint Co. was awarded the general contract or the direct contract from the Regents on the Robert Mondavi Wine and Food Institute up north at UC Davis. And Flint Co. subcontracted out to Architectural Security Doors, or ASP is their nickname. ASP was given the subcontract to supply all the custom fabricated doors pursuant to plans and specs on the project. Well, ASP decided to subcontract all of that work out to Eggers. And so ASP's contract was only to furnish the doors, not to install, just to furnish the doors. And Eggers did all the manufacturing of those doors. They did all the work. So Eggers was so confident that they didn't get paid by ASP, so they went ahead and filed their claim on the payment bond, and they filed a lawsuit to enforce that claim. And during the court proceeding, they actually filed a plaintiff's motion for summary judgment because they were so confident. And so this is a slam dunk. We supplied these custom doors pursuant to plans and specs. It's an old case that we rely upon a lot is the Thiessen case, and it's just like the Thiessen case. And even though it was done off-site, we're still entitled to make a claim on our payment bond. And the surety, which was Federal Insurance Company and Fidelity and Deposit of Maryland, those two sureties teamed up and opposed the motion for summary judgment and said, well, wait a minute, guys. ASP was actually a material man. They weren't a subcontractor because they didn't do anything on this project. They were just they gave it all to you, Eggers, and so you were just a supplier to a supplier. And so it was an interesting argument, and in fact, the counsel that I spoke with this morning, we were talking about that issue, where it was really just a pass-through. And can you call somebody a subcontractor if they haven't done anything on a project? And the court here at Eggers in the 3rd District said, yes, it doesn't matter what you did on the project. It matters what you agreed to do. And so if your subcontract was to supply custom doors pursuant to plans and specs, you are now, quote-unquote, in charge of that work. And so you are considered, ASP is considered a subcontractor. And therefore, because Eggers was the supplier to the subcontractor, they were entitled to enforce their payment bond rights. What I think is sort of the bigger impact potentially of this decision, and I write about it a little bit in the CEB book that my partner Mike Wayne and I have co-authored a couple chapters in that CEB book, is that this opinion conflicts with two other appellate opinions in the 2nd and the 4th District of California. And you all probably know that there's different appellate districts around the state of California, and sometimes they don't agree with each other. Well, we had two old cases, and old, I mean 10 years old or even 6 years old, which said that it doesn't matter where you fall as far as privity or tiers. If you could be a third-tier sub-subcontractor, and you still have California payment bond rights. No issue. Well, this court, at least in dicta, disagrees with it. And this court says, this court is really saying that you're on par with the federal Miller Act statute, which limits recovery to those folks that are subs or suppliers to a first-tier subcontractor only. And so that's a big deal. For those of you that rely upon California payment bond rights, you got to know who's above you, because this court at least believes that you have a limitation, that if you are a sub to a sub-sub or a supplier to a sub-sub, you don't have payment bond rights under the California Public Works statute. So it is a clear conflict in our law, and we will see, I'm sure at some point soon, a California Supreme Court decision which looks at these different ideas from the different appellate districts and to come up with a hard and fast rule. And also, I will point out that it is important for those of you that practice in different jurisdictions, you've got to look at the Little Miller Act statute of the different states, or the Federal Miller Act if you're supplying on a federal job, to see where you fit in the tier structure and what's required of the folks above you. Because like in states like Washington, they may require you to do actual on-site work to be considered a subcontractor. So if your customer isn't doing on-site work in the state of Washington, you may have an issue enforcing your public works payment bond statute. So it's something to think about. The final case that I wanted to mention briefly is this Pioneer Construction case that came out about 16 months ago. And it was it's always nice when we have a bankruptcy case, because we don't see a lot of them, where bankruptcy law and mechanics lien law intersect. So this is always a nice thing. And all this case really stands for is a couple of propositions, and I'll give you a little bit of the facts first, and that is that our claimant recorded a mechanics lien on a project where the owner had already filed bankruptcy. So there was a bankruptcy filing. The claimant files its mechanics lien about 4 months after the bankruptcy filing, and then filed a notice of perfection of lien with the bankruptcy court within 90 days thereafter. And eventually, the lenders sold the property at a trustee sale during the bankruptcy proceeding, and the new buyer had the property. And the contractor, Pioneer Construction, files its lawsuit to enforce the mechanics lien 79 days after the property was sold. So the buyer, of course, is not very happy with this lawsuit. And so the buyer challenges two actions by Pioneer. Number one, that you violated the automatic stay by recording a mechanics lien after the bankruptcy filing. And number two, you waited too long because you recorded your mechanics lien in month one, and you didn't file your lawsuit until month 11. So you don't have the proper timing. And the court here confirms what I think we generally understand is a truism here in California, at least in the bankruptcy courts in the Ninth Circuit here in California, which is that, number one, you do not violate the automatic stay by recording your mechanics lien. Even after the owner files bankruptcy, you can do that. You can go ahead and record your mechanics lien. And this decision is in line with other decisions. And secondly, when the bankruptcy is filed, your time to foreclose upon that lien is tolled. It's tolled until that property is sold out of bankruptcy. So that's what happened here, is once the mechanics lien was recorded during the bankruptcy, so the 90-day clock never started ticking to file the lawsuit. But as soon as that property was sold on August 25th, 2009, from that date forward, Pioneer had 90 days to file its lawsuit, and here they did so 79 days later. So something to keep in mind is whenever you have, if you're a claimant and you haven't been paid and your owner has filed bankruptcy, record your lien and make sure you do that notice of perfection of mechanics lien within 90 days after you do so, and then monitor the bankruptcy to see if and when that property comes out of the bankruptcy estate, because then your clock may start ticking again. Hope that was helpful.
Great. Thank you, Chris.